Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ, San Diego, and worldwide at KCBQ.com. The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Reoccurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but how can you serve God if there's no evidence that God is real? And even if there were evidence for some kind of God, some kind of deity, some kind of powerful being, how would you know it's necessarily the God of the Bible? Couldn't it be some other kind of God? Such as the deist view of God, an impersonal deity who created the universe but does not involve himself in human affairs. We are going to explore this provocative topic later in the program. Our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. Boy, I must say, government and pop culture certainly merged together in my thinking this past week. Most of you have heard the phrase, if I've told you once, I've told you a thousand times. Well, this is especially true for an unusual story told in the film Groundhog Day. Should be a very familiar film to a lot of you. Well, I had the pleasure of introducing my girlfriend to this movie over the weekend, courtesy of DVD. I'm not on Blu-ray yet, but DVD. Now, this movie, of course, is some 20 years old by now, but I'm not sure how she missed it. I was still glad that she missed it. It actually added to the fun. I enjoy sharing favorite movies. I feel like I'm vicariously watching them afresh through the reactions of one who had not gone down that trail before. Of course, after this particular movie was over, both of us felt like we had watched about 50 showings in a row. This is because of the premise. Bill Murray, awakening every morning to the same obnoxious Sonny and Cher tune blasting out of his bed and breakfast room's radio alarm clock at the commencement of shivering, icy cold Groundhog Day, a 24-hour period Murray is destined to repeat over and over. A number of years ago, there was talk about turning Groundhog Day into a Broadway musical. I'll never forget, Shepard Smith of Fox News shared a brief report. He says, "And if you like the movie Groundhog Day, you'll be interested to know there are plans for a new musical version on Broadway." At this point, Shep glances down at his desk, then looks up with the exact same expression and says once again, "And if you like the movie Groundhog Day, you'll be interested to know that there are plans for a new musical version on Broadway." Clever movie, clever version of the news, Shep. Unfortunately, those of us who live in the modest little city of Santee, California, have been experiencing a not-so-clever Groundhog Day of our own. A couple of weeks ago, signs were posted in front of every house on my block explaining how our streets were going to be repaved between the hours of 7 a.m. and 5 p.m. on a forthcoming date. No cars were allowed on the streets during road construction. This meant each and every resident either had to park his car around the corner the night before or rise and shine before 7 a.m. to relocate the vehicle. Otherwise, your car is stuck in the driveway and you can't leave your home all day. You could miss work. You could miss a doctor's appointment or miss an opportunity to go out and buy lunch should your refrigerator not be stocked. On the other hand, stranded people would still be able to hang around the house and watch TV, possibly another showing of Groundhog Day. In any event, the city was right on the ball, giving us plenty of notice a whole week before the road construction was slated to begin. And heck, How big of a deal could it be to move our car just this one time in exchange for a smooth, pothole-free street? When D-Day arrived, I moved my car the night before. Most of my neighbors chose the early bird option, but crack of dawn rising is not numbered among my unique talents. Oh, sure, I've heard of such things as mourning, but that's not quite the same as actually experiencing the phenomenon. In any event, it never mattered when I moved my car. Indeed, my car didn't need to be moved at all. At the end of the day, nothing had been done to the street. There wasn't even the slightest hint of change. Well, actually, I take that back. There was something new. A new date on a new slab of cardboard slapped and pasted over the original day and time, informing us of an alternative rendezvous with road construction postponed and rescheduled for a future morning. So a couple of days later, I moved my car again, this time dealing with dawn and awakening before 7 a.m. What happened at the end of that day? Herman's Hermits would put it best. Second verse, same as the first. No paved road. Another remarked sign instead. This temporal loop has happened multiple times now. I've actually lost track of the exact number. Somewhere between 5 or 6 repeat performances, I think, creating a whole new interpretation of deja vu. As one might expect, there has not been so much as a hint of apology from the city of Santee and their accomplished collection of bureaucrats. We, the citizens, are expected to either move our cars or face the possibility of being stranded every time they put up that stupid sign. They, on the other hand, seem to feel no obligation to follow through with their part of the deal. Of course, that one day I decide not to worry about moving my car will be the same day those 7 dwarfs finally show up, ready for work.
My home, my home, my home, my home, my home, my home, it's home from work we go. My home.
Didn't our local government ever learn that it's impolite to keep breaking a date, especially after promising that long-term, solid, paved relationship? How's this for our tax dollars hard at work? Not only does our money pay for the pavement, we also pay for the red cones and staked signs telling us about the road construction, and then each time the project gets delayed, we're paying for whomever the city hires to go around and change the date on the signs for the umpteenth time. I suppose I could write a letter to the city and complain, but I doubt that too many of these officials are actually losing any sleep over this phantom project that the rest of us are forced to literally lose sleep over. It's not as if we can fire one road construction company and hire another. Government doesn't work that way, which is why I just can't wait to see what government does with our healthcare system as they head toward that coveted single-payer system. Oh, I'm sure it will be delightful. Some might argue that I should still write a protest just to let my voice be numb. Not a bad idea. Then again, I can't help but wonder who would be hired to read such letters and how much of our tax money goes to pay them. And while we're on that subject, how much of our tax dollars go to pay the salaries of men and women who make big promises and then lose their nerve once they get to Washington? In some cases, they buckle under while still on the campaign circuit. Republican gubernatorial candidate Carl Paladino serves as an example. You've all heard this story, I'm sure. After speaking against gay pride parades and the brainwashing of children into accepting the lifestyle, he did this before a group of Orthodox Jewish rabbis. Well, then after that, Paladino came under severe attack from the media and found himself apologizing for his remarks. He said, and I quote, "I sincerely apologize for any comment that may have offended the gay and lesbian community or their family members. Any reference to branding an entire community based on a small representation of them is wrong." Okay, that was his comment. Well, yes, it is wrong, as a matter of fact, to brand an entire community based on a small representation of them. Too bad nobody in the mainstream media points out how militant gay activists brand anyone who disagrees with their lifestyle as hateful, bigoted, homophobic. It goes on and on. Even when people are treating them with respect and love despite the disagreement, even when most Christians have condemned churches like Westboro Baptist. But I agree that gay activists are not speaking for all homosexuals. They are merely the squeaky wheels getting the grease. And boy, do they get a lot of grease, at least a lot of grease from judicial activism. On the other hand, if the militant gay agenda was Palladino's only concern, and examples of such an agenda were the only examples he cited, he does not really have anything to apologize for, does he? Gay pride parades do exhibit a kind of behavior that would not be allowed in front of our children if the sexual innuendo were hetero. I mean, who are we kidding? As for children being brainwashed in our schools, what can I say, folks? It's happening. It's happening in many places, Massachusetts being one example which jumps to mind, along with other states where gay marriage is legal and those who fought for the legality promised there would be no slippery slope involving our educational system. Oh no, there hasn't been a slippery slope at all. We're just going to read books to your kids like Heather has two mommies. Now the Orthodox rabbis feel Palladino is going back on this first speech. I suppose it can be argued that on one hand, Palladino didn't mean to offend, while on the other hand, he stands by his convictions. Politicians are great with this whole one hand, other hand routine. Unfortunately, it comes across like a compromise because at the end of the day, that is just exactly what it is. A compromise. Not very promising in a historical election year when we were hoping, naive as the hope might be, to see such political maneuvering go the way of the dodo bird. If Palladino had half a spine, he'd give yet another speech and say, why do we keep rolling over and playing dead for those who espouse a lifestyle that most people do not honestly agree with and are just afraid to speak up against? Oh, he'd get in trouble if he gave that speech. The New York Times would hate it, and Joy Behar would feel compelled to walk out of the room. But you'd be surprised how many more people might vote for Mr. Palladino in the privacy of a curtain-hidden booth after looking both ways and making sure nobody is watching. My friends, I'm not saying I won't respect you if you hold a different view than me about homosexuality or any of the other controversial subjects we discuss, such as the war on terror, radical Islam, views on big government versus small government, but I will challenge you to make sure your beliefs are truly your beliefs. Don't compromise just to be popular or just to blend with the crowd. Don't compromise just because you want to act like you know about something when you haven't really studied it. When people feel too intimidated to speak out, something dies within. Compromise destroys the soul of a person. Compromise destroys the soul of a nation.
Which started the whole world crying, but I didn't see that the joke was on me. Oh no, I started to cry, which started the whole. Oh, if I'd only see that the joke was on me. Sing. finally died, which started the whole world living. Oh, if I'd only seen, oh yeah, that the joke was on me.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. There is a rather serious amendment to my opening monologue. I'm talking to you live right now, but my monologue was pre-recorded this week. As part of the monologue, I was reading aloud from an article I published on the recently award-winning online magazine San Diego Rostra. The article was entitled Groundhog Day in Santee. Well, the morning after that article was published, I found the following comment up on the Rostra from Brian Jones, vice mayor of Santee. And he wrote, "Bob, consider your protest adequately written. I know me saying I'll look into it doesn't fix the problem, but I will. I hope your new pavement is a pleasure to drive on." I have no problem with new pavement at all if they actually give us the new pavement. But let me respond more specifically to what Brian Jones is saying, because ironically, by writing an article about why I am not going to waste my time writing the city government saw my complaint in writing anyway. Only in online modern journalism could things like that happen so quickly. We live in a wondrous world. So I then responded over the Rostra, and I wrote, "My thanks to Brian Jones. I know you to be a man of integrity. As you can see, I was having fun with the subject matter, but yes, it is a real issue, and I do appreciate you looking into it. Warmest regards, Bob Siegel." Now, I wasn't just saying that. I have worked with Brian Jones at tea parties, and I have interviewed him on the radio. He's a very nice guy. Then the Rostra administrator kicked in and said, "Real action right here, Bob, we dub thee the Turco of Rostra." Then I love this next comment from a guy with the nickname D7 Voter. He says, "Move to San Diego. You won't have to worry about your streets being repaved ever." Well, then, a few days later, Vice Mayor Brian Jones says again, "I sure do like DC7 voters' response," not DC7, D7. He says, "We are trying to stay ahead of the potholes in Santee. The good news, and friendly correction to the article, in Santee, we can fire one road construction crew and hire another because we subcontract to private companies. And when they don't do their job properly, they are not asked to come back. Now, your comment regarding healthcare, that's still accurate. The reason for the delays was the uncooperative weather. Unfortunately, that does not excuse the poor communication to the neighborhood, and we will do better next time. Bob, I know this does not fix the past problem, but I assure you the city manager is on this and will make the necessary improvements. Finally, I responded again. I said to Brian Jones, first, many thanks for looking into this. I do need to mention that in all the days this was delayed, it rained only once that I can recall. Even then, it only looked like it might rain. Even a notice, which finally did come out a couple of days ago, offering the very first explanation apology, said it was due to weather and unforeseen conditions. What were those unforeseen conditions? That's the question. Anyway, Mr. Jones, this is the only point I wanted to make, but only for clarification, not to sound ungrateful for your efforts. Again, I do appreciate that you looked into this. Now, let me tell you all, tomorrow morning, they're scheduled to come out and pave my roads again. I have a feeling they're really going to do it this time. But boy, if they don't, well, then I won't have to wonder what to write in my weekly column for the San Diego Rostra, will I? A couple of weeks ago, we had a fellow caller show. Nice guy named Tim. It wasn't my show. I substitute host for Rick Amato a lot. And I was on the Rick Amato show talking about some evidence for the existence of God. He called in. We started sparring in a friendly way. I had a guest at the time, so I told him I couldn't give him a lot of time, but invited him to call my own program. Then I remembered that I had guests slated for the next 2 weeks in a row on my own program. So I threw out this date as a time when he could call in and we could get into it. Tim notified me yesterday that he was planning to call, but of course, just as unforeseen things stop the road construction, maybe there's something that's preventing Tim from calling in. He actually said he'd call as close to 3:15 as he can. I suppose it's still close to 3:15. So Tim, if you're out there, feel free to give us a call, but I am going to go ahead and continue the discussion that Tim and I, in a sense, started. Now, as we got into it, I was giving an argument for the existence of God. He didn't care for the argument, but he did volunteer that he himself, he said he was an agnostic leaning toward deism. Let me define some of these terms. There are two different kinds of agnostics. There's the agnostic who says there may or may not be a God. Now, that's a position that I can respect. Atheists come out and just dogmatically claim that there is no God. They love to mentioned that Christians and other theists view God by blind faith, which I don't think any of us should do. I don't think we should follow God by blind faith, but many Christians do. And atheists jump all over that, as they should jump all over anything that's done by blind faith. However, then the atheists make these dogmatic assertions that God doesn't exist. And when you say, well, can you prove to me that God doesn't exist? They'll say, well, you don't prove a negative. If you're going to claim that God does exist, then you have the positive assertion. Well, when atheists say it's illogical to believe in God or there is no God, those are positive assertions too. But an agnostic says there might be a God, there might not be a God. I think that's an intellectually honest position. So that's what an agnostic is. We'll talk more about agnostics and deists and you name it on The Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785, that's 447-8785, for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric. Does God exist or not exist? An agnostic is one who says, I don't know. There may or may not be a God. I'm open to the evidence. Atheists, there's two kinds of atheists. There's the kind that just says there is no God, period. But then they really can't back that up. They really can't prove it. Now, there are more thoughtful atheists, and these are usually the kind that join atheist communities, atheist clubs. They will admit a little more grudgingly than the agnostic, but they will admit that there may be a God, but they would say, so far we've examined all of the evidence and there is none. If you can give us better evidence, sure, we'll look at it, but we're really not expecting that to happen. So that's the more thoughtful atheist view. An agnostic is one who will look at the evidence and say, maybe there is, maybe there isn't a God. Now, there's another kind of agnostic also. There's the kind of person who says, I do believe there's a God, but I'm agnostic as to who this God is. Maybe he's the God of the Bible. Maybe he's the God of the Quran. Maybe he's not the God of either of them. And then our friend who called us in a few weeks ago, he said then that he was an agnostic, open to the possibility of there being a God, leaning more toward deism. Now, of course, people attach different definitions to words, and we get sub-meanings and subsections of groups all the time. But the most generalized definition of a deist, and it's become a popular word lately because it's commonly ascribed to Thomas Jefferson, deism, and to Ben Franklin, deism. They were forefathers. They had a great respect for Christianity. They certainly weren't teaching that you can't read the Bible or pray in the public school. But these men were deists. Now, they claimed to be deists. When you look at some of the things they said about God, they seem to describe God a little more personally. A deist is one who says there's a God, but they don't believe that God really involves himself in personal affairs. Often the illustration of the watchmaker is given, that God kind of wound the universe up, and now he just sits back and he watches. And the reason deism is an intellectually satisfying position for some people is they don't have to explain some of the bigger questions which pop on the scene when we claim that there's a loving God. For example, if God is a loving God, why do we have suffering in the world? Why does God allow evil things to happen? Why do we have hurricanes and tornadoes and tidal waves and diseases? And why do people die of cancer? And if somebody were murdered or somebody was raped, why didn't God stop them? If he's all powerful and he's also all loving, then we have a real problem. There was a man that named James McLeish. He wrote a play a number of years ago called J.B. J.B. was kind of a modern version of the story of Job. And I'll never forget one of the lines that he wrote. It was a very catchy line. He said, if God is God, he is not good. If God is good, he is not God. Very profound words. If God is really all powerful and good, then there shouldn't be any evil because he would stop the evil. On the other hand, some say, and there's a rabbi who wrote a book a number of years ago who claimed that maybe God just couldn't do everything. Maybe God was not all powerful, and maybe he's personal, and maybe he loves us, but he's just not all powerful. Well, the deist view would just say that God's just not involved in human affairs. They wouldn't necessarily bother to explain why that is, but this is a God who created the universe and does not involve himself in human affairs. Well, it looks like our friend Tim has called in, so we're going to go ahead and go to the lines. And Tim, welcome to the Bob Siegel Show.
Hi, Bob. Sorry, it took me a little while to call in. I was tired of watching the Chargers lose.
You know, I have a good friend named Ross who may or may not be listening, but he comes to my Sunday school class, and I can always tell whether the Chargers are playing in the morning based on whether Ross is in class or not. But anyway, it's uh-oh, looks like we just lost him. But look, Todd's going ahead and trying to get him back. So if you're listening over the radio, Tim, you might want to try us from a landline rather than a cell phone. I should have mentioned that. Cell phones are extremely unpredictable on the air. Well, I'll go ahead and continue talking about deism while we're waiting for Tim to return. So far, the only discussion we had about God was that the Chargers were losing. So hopefully, we'll add a little more depth. Or maybe we could raise questions like, if God is such a loving God, why would the Chargers lose? Tim, are you back on the line? I'm not hearing him.
I'm actually trying to find a better signal. All I have is my mobile phone, and I'm doing my best. I'm doing my best here.
Okay. Are you driving, or are you in one stationary place?
I am parking as we speak. With a hands-free device, so don't worry.
Okay, yeah, if you could keep the car parked, that would at least help. But, okay, So I don't know if you caught, I went ahead and I know you had mentioned that you were a deist, so I started a little bit of a discussion about deism. I don't know if you had a chance to hear it or if you were busy trying to get on the air during that time.
I did hear it, and I think what I said was I consider myself more of an agnostic with some deist tendencies or leanings.
Yeah, in other words, if you were to consider God, the deist view of God makes more sense so far than the other versions of God. Would that be a fair way to say it? But you're not necessarily sure that any of the versions are correct.
I'm not necessarily sure, I think keeping an open mind is important, and I trust you do as well.
Yeah, no, you sound like a very open-minded person to me. I felt that way when we talked. And so I just want to let everybody in the audience know the purpose of having a discussion like this is it's just nice for people to be informed of their different positions. I'm not assuming that at the end of this discussion, I'm necessarily going to persuade Tim, and he's not going to necessarily persuade me. On the other hand, one of us may give the other something to think about, such is the nature of discussion. So with that idea then, Tim, I know we were kind of in the middle of something on the Rick Amato show, and I know you would have had more to say if we had had some time. So I'm going to give you a chance to just pick us up from where we left off, or if you'd like to take us another direction, that's fine too.
I think it's fair to right where we left off on the Rick Amato show when you were covering it was we were talking about the innate sense of right and wrong.
Yes, and I was using that as not proof for the existence of God, but I was offering that as what I would call rational evidence. I very carefully define evidence and proof as two different things.
Right, and right when we had to end, I was talking about the biological nature of conscience, of not consciousness, but having a conscience. And,
yes.
And you seem to agree that a conscience was not a supernatural thing, but rather a biological thing with a genetic component.
Yes, and I should also say my definition of supernatural, when I talk about a miracle or when the Bible talks about a miracle, I don't believe they're talking about something that defies science, but rather something that challenges science as we currently know about it. For example, if somebody a couple of hundred years ago saw you talking on your cell phone or saw your iPod or saw a rocket ship land on the moon, that would look miraculous to them. To us, we've just harnessed a science that they don't yet understand. So then my argument would be, well, then if human beings can do marvelous things 1,000 years from now that would boggle our minds, maybe the same God who created all scientific law could do the same thing. So even when I'm talking about the supernatural, I don't mean it in any way that violates reality as we understand it.
So with that in mind, does that mean you believe in a conscience that has a material base or a non-material, non-detectable, non-containable, non-testable substance of some kind?
I believe it is both. There, of course, the whole field of neurology, any neurologist, and I had a chance to interview one of them once, they would be the first to admit that we still know so little about what makes the human mind think. But I believe that the human mind, the human brain, is both physical and spiritual, that it's very intertwined, and that we don't know exactly where it overlaps. So I would agree with you when you talk about the conscience being, when you suggested that maybe it's something innate, something that was, I think I said, programmed into our DNA, as opposed to the common view of the conscience that society just kind of invented right and wrong. I do think society comes up with ideas of right and wrong. I think underneath that, there are some, more correctly put, there's one moral absolute that I think we would all agree to. And that is the moral absolute of treating other people the way we would want to be treated, treating other people with respect. From culture to culture, the definition of respect sometimes changes. Let me give you a chance to respond to that.
When you recite the golden rule, are you saying how we want people to treat us, we should treat others how they treat us, or we should treat others how they want to be treated?
Well, to me, that's two ways. I understand we could be semanticists. To me, that's two ways of saying the same thing. In other words, yeah, and I wouldn't go up to somebody and say, well, I think you want to be treated with your head being clobbered. No, it's treat them the way they would want to be treated, unless it's some kind of person who is just self-destructive. Okay, it's, if it's like a masochist or somebody that, or a sadist, that would be, you know, they may want things that are not appropriate. Could you hang with me over the break, Tim, and we'll return to this conversation?
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll be right back. To build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show 4 nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show, Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com. Welcome back to our program. My friend Tim, or my acquaintance, nice guy, I think we could become friends, is on the line. Tim, welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show.
Good to be here.
Okay, so we were talking about the conscience, and we were talking about the fact that, in my opinion, when we're studying the brain has a spiritual and a physical component. Even the Bible didn't try to break up human beings into immaterial and material as much as theologians sometimes do. So oftentimes what sounds kind of fanciful when people are referring to the Bible is somebody's version of the Bible and not necessarily what the Bible itself would say. But I wanted to give you a chance to respond to some of these things.
Well, just so, you know, I don't want to pigeonhole you or anything, but are you somewhere like a substance dualist or a property dualist or something else, just so I understand?
No, dualism was a Greek philosophy that believed that material things were evil and that non-material things were good. When the Bible uses terms like spirit and flesh, it means very different things than that, but I can understand why people will attach similar definitions to word. When the Bible calls a man spiritual, it means the body and the soul together when it's in obedience to God. And when the Bible calls a man fleshly or carnal or sinful, it means the body and the soul together when it's in disobedience to God. So flesh and blood and soul is neutral as far as being good or bad. What makes it good or bad are the choices and actions that we make. Does that make sense?
It does, but then what is the soul exactly?
The soul would be yourself, your feelings, your emotions, and your soul is connected to your brain. Then there's a subsection of the soul that the Bible calls the spirit. And that would be where your conscience is. Through the conscience, through the spirit, people tend to commune with God and vice versa. Through the body, the soul tends to commune with people. So the soul communes with people through the body. It communes with God through the conscience. Now, obviously, God can also speak audibly. There are examples in the Bible of God speaking audibly and people experiencing him through the physical senses as well. But even without God speaking audibly, his spirit can speak to us through our conscience. And I'm not saying, incidentally, that God's spirit and our conscience are the same thing. Here's an analogy that's been helpful to me, Tim. Think of the conscience as a radar, and think of God's spirit as what that radar might be homing in on.
The reason why I'm trying to understand where you're coming from is for things like our personality, our emotions, conscious thought, our intellectual thoughts inside our mind, are all directly, measurably, and predictably affectable by material things. Anything from, of course, drugs to deprivation of oxygen to a lack of simple glucose can directly, measurably, predictably affect all of these things.
You're absolutely right about that. And the reverse is also true, that how we're doing emotionally can set off the body in certain ways and set off chemical reactions in the body. And that's why, you know, when you get into the field of psychology as opposed to psychiatry, sometimes you get into this which came first, the chicken or the egg thing, because absolutely environment and the drugs can affect our emotions, but our emotions can also stimulate the body in certain ways. So I would say that both of those are true.
So understanding that to be the case, if it looks to me like emotions and personality and all these things, it all sounds all within the physical realm, material physical realm. Do you agree with that, or are you saying that there's a non-physical, non-material?
There's a non-physical, non-material component, but it's something that we're never going to be able to identify in some kind of test tube. So what we would have to do is ask greater philosophical questions to see if there's a philosophical evidence that they're there. For example, when we're talking about personality, we would have to ask the question, can the personal come from the impersonal? If we wanted to take, and as you know, there are different kinds of evolutionists. There are theistic evolutionists that believe some kind of creator started the evolutionary process. But there are non-theistic evolutionists that believe we're here by randomness and chance. They would have to wrestle with the question of where personality came from, because no matter how many billions of years they give it or how gradual of a process they want to assume, there's still a point where it goes from A to B. And when we're looking at the universe, stars, rocks, dust, chemicals, those things don't think. It has to be a certain combination of chemicals to eventually create consciousness and sentience. This is a field, this is of interest in the field of artificial intelligence as they're working on computers and they're trying to speculate as to whether we can ever completely mimic the human brain. Well, they haven't yet figured out what makes us conscious. There's an actual mystery involved here, but the question of where consciousness came from raises the question of whether we believe it's more logical for the personal to come from the impersonal or the personal to come from the personal. And hold with me over another break. I'm going to give you a long time to respond to that because I know I took a long time to lay it out. I'm here with my friend Tim. We're talking about evidence or lack thereof for the existence of God.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I'm here with Tim, a very open-minded individual. And so, Tim, where I'm going with this is getting back to what we were talking about on the Rick Amato show, we could say that the conscience, is just something material and that it comes from just chemicals. But for somebody to live consistently with the view that it wasn't programmed in with some kind of God, we would have to say that any morality we choose to have or not choose to have, we should be free to make that choice. The moment I wanted to look at somebody and say it's wrong to steal, or it's wrong to murder, or it's wrong to be racist, he could always say, well, who says it's wrong? There's no God. You're somebody that just happened to evolve by randomness and chance. I'm somebody who happened to evolve by randomness and chance. And I'm free to divorce myself from the way I evolved anytime I want. And so it raises the question of whether we can be consistent with moral values if there is no God. Go ahead.
Well, just to be clear, evolution is not about randomness and chance. It's about random mutation within the context of a lot of factors, most prominent of which is natural selection. I don't want to get sidetracked on that because I want to stick with this moral stuff, but it's a lot more complicated, and it's not just randomness and chance.
I've had this conversation with others who would say that, because I don't think human beings want to believe they are a product of randomness and chance. But I don't want to get sidetracked on it either, but just for clarification, if there is no God that started this process, then however the process developed and evolved, it is random. If it doesn't have some kind of sentience beyond it that planned it that way, its origin, at least, is randomness. If we believe it eventually became complex and works according to certain rules, I think that gives us even more of a mystery, because where did these rules come from?
Well, we're going to go in this direction. I can't let it go.
Go ahead.
What you're getting down to is where do the laws of physics come from? In other words,
and how do you have how do you have any laws without a lawgiver and lawmaker? Exactly.
Well, it's an interesting issue, but I think this is where some agnosticism is healthy and open-mindedness is healthy, because the fact is we don't know. And philosophically, we don't know. Evidence-wise, we don't know. And the reality is, we can make these arguments, but the reality is we don't know whether our universe with its properties is necessary to have the properties it has, whether it could have any other properties or constants, whether there are literally an infinite number of multiverses, and our universe would not only would our universe exist, but you could say an infinite number of universes would exist just like ours, except things are just slightly different. Instead of Bob, maybe your name is Joe, but everything else is the same. This is a very deep point that can't be glossed over so easily as to say, well, there's a law, there must be a lawgiver. We really don't know the answers to these things.
Well, it depends on where we're starting. I would agree with you this much. At the beginning of an open-minded conversation, if somebody has not actually encountered or experienced God, which would change everything, but if somebody has not encountered or experienced God, then yes, we could say we have these laws in the universe, and that's why I was so careful to distinguish between evidence and proof. Now, when I look at the laws of the universe, would I say that automatically proves the existence of God? No. But let me ask you the question, if we wanted to just view it in terms of rational evidence, does it make more rational sense to look at the theory that it came from God, or is the theory that there is no lawgiver and yet somehow we still have laws, is that the more logical theory? Because I do think we could ask which looks like a more logical, rational theory, even though I would agree with you, at that level, we still don't absolutely positively know.
This is where the casual intuition and the more detailed reflection come in conflict.
Yes,
I would agree with you that the casual reflection agrees with your point of view. But the deeper analysis of things like how science works, physics works, how quantum physics works is the most unintuitive thing in the world, yet it's shown over and over again to work in this intensely unintuitive way. And the world and the universe works in so many unintuitive ways that it's really, really hard to understand on that level. And that's why I say there's a difference between the casual observation. If we look around, we say, oh, well, nature is so ordered. It's so perfect. It has to be placed in this sort of way. And then we look deeper into a long history of nature, and we find catastrophes and disasters and really, really clunky and poor so-called designs of biological systems that are really amazing in some ways, but really, like, if there was a designer, there's no way an intelligent designer would do it this way. So it really, it's really a complex issue that isn't so easily determined by just saying, well, you just look at it, it just makes sense. I mean, if that's the way we're going to approach these deep issues, we've got much bigger problems, I think.
Okay, well, let's go back to what you were saying when you talk about the intuitive and deeper approach, because the moment we say, gee, there's no way a complicated creator would have created it this way, then we're admitting that we ourselves seem to operate according to certain laws of logic, certain senses of morality. The moment somebody says, how could a loving God allow somebody to die in a hurricane, they're assuming that we should be loving. If there's a God, he should be loving. This gets back to my original question. Where did this idea that human beings should be loving and should treat each other a certain way came from? If it was invented by humans, I can disagree with the inventions that a bunch of people who are here randomly came up with at any time. I know you don't like the word random. I didn't forget that. But as a conventional reference point, I'm going to use that word. If we believe that we just happen to evolve a certain way, then again, if I happen to evolve a certain way, and there, let's assume that neither one of us believes in God, and I turn to you and I say, is it wrong to go out and murder somebody in cold blood? I'm not talking about self-defense. I mean, just for no reason other than that you hate the person, you feel like killing them. You seem like a person of high moral conscience. I think you would say that, I'm pretty sure you would say that's wrong. Am I correct?
Because I'm not a psychopath,
okay.
I would say that's wrong. And this gets me right. I read your book. You sent it to me. Thank you so much. I'm reading it. And you say on page 103, you say, every human conscience agrees with God's standards I set forth in the Bible, because there's really only one standard, a standard easy to affirm, as you would have people treat you, treat them. So this is, every human conscience has this golden rule embedded in them.
Well, I did go on later in the book, and I did add the amendment and distinction that there are people that we call sociopaths and psychopaths. So I appreciate the point you're making. Sometimes we talk in generalities. Every person with a working conscience, and I did. I know you haven't read the whole book. I did move on later on and make that distinction. The very fact that we call somebody a psychopath or a sociopath demonstrates that we're saying the conscience is a real thing and their conscience just is not working. It's like somebody being born without the ability to walk and yet they still have legs. We wouldn't say legs don't exist just because somebody doesn't have the ability to walk and there was a birth defect. So there are defective consciences. You're absolutely right about that. In general, though, we agree that the conscience is a real thing. And right. In fact, our very definitions of psychopath and sociopath couldn't exist without that reference point. We can't even define a psychopath as unless we say he's a person whose conscience is not working. The minute we say conscience is not working, we're saying there's such a thing as the conscience.
So let's take that reality. Like you said, you know, some people can be born with eyes, but they're blind, right? And we wouldn't say they don't have eyes. We might say they don't have sight, but they don't have eyes. We wouldn't say they don't have eyes. We recognize eyes are a physical thing. So let's move forward just a little bit and say, okay, people are born with the biologically, you know, they have a brain, but there's something internal about them that they're not working with the same sort of innate sense of morality that the rest of us are. They're born that way. And I think you'll agree there's plenty of evidence to suggest and plenty of studies to suggest there's some people that are simply born without the same conscience that almost all the rest of us
have. That is true in some cases, and yet most people who commit acts of evil do have a conscience which bothers them, and the fact that they usually have to rationalize it. Even the worst racists will say things like, oh, people of this skin color are subhuman. Hitler tried to teach that the Jews were subhuman, because the moment they admitted that these people were human, they knew there was a certain way we should treat them. So I think most of the time, even the most evil actions are done by people who know that evil is wrong. But yes, there are some people who just don't have a conscience at all. That's true.
So let's get back to the question you asked me is, murder. Why don't we just all murder everybody? Why don't we just all rape everybody? Why don't we all steal from everybody? Why don't we all, you know, take and act in violence and do all these things? And then So ask yourself, what sort of behavior is more beneficial to the population of humanity?
Okay, I see where you're going with this, but the problem is when human beings make decisions, they don't always stop to ask what benefits society. This is what you're espousing is frequently called the wolf pack theory, that I'm making certain choices for the benefit of the long-term society. But most human beings just look within the realm of their own life. They do what they want to do. They do selfish things, and they still feel guilty. And we would have to ask where that guilt comes from.
You're right. We do have to ask where the guilt comes from, but I'm getting back to the innate sense of right and wrong.
And where that comes from. We're out of time, unfortunately. Would you like to call in again next week? Because I know we just barely got started. Next week,
I'll do it a lot earlier next time. I called late.
Not a problem at all. I really appreciate you coming on. I thought it was a great discussion. I appreciate where you're coming from, and let's talk about this again next week.
You got it, Bob. Thank
okay, you. My friend. Thank you for calling in. We'll see you next week, everybody.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.